and we'll just get, we'll get going. And I'll introduce the other panelists as we move forward. The picture here is of a hospital in Chechnya, one of many, many hospitals that were bombed in the course of the war in Chechnya. And one of the things to note about these attacks is when we have reports of attacks on hospitals or health workers, the reports tend to focus on immediate casualties. That is, how many people were killed, how many were wounded. But when you see this hospital and you think 2 weeks from the time of the incident, if a woman had an emergency obstetrical need or someone had a heart attack, there's no place to go. So these attacks have very long-lasting impacts. I have no relationships to disclose. This is required by APHA. If I could just give you some examples in recent years of the kinds of attacks we're talking about. Just 2 years ago, at the end of the war in Sri Lanka, where the government had isolated the Tamil Tiger rebels on this spit of land, and the rebels forced the civilian population into that same spit of land as a way, kind of as a human shield, and the Sri Lankan army refused to recognize that and bombed, shelled the civilian population, including what is now documented as 30 separate instances of bombing and shelling medical facilities in a mere 6 months. 10 different hospitals were hit many multiple times, and you'll see in a moment how they were destroyed. As I mentioned a moment ago, we can look at casualty figures. That's a lot of people killed in discrete attacks on 10 facilities, but the impact was far beyond the immediate impact, as we'll see. And on top of that, this is another dimension of the problem of attacks on health, which is underreported, which is that governments or rebel forces, whoever they may be, detain, prosecute, torture doctors, as we've seen in Bahrain as well, for providing care to the other side. And so that happened after the war as well. Here's basically what happened in Sri Lanka. In the upper left, we see an attack on a hospital. It's burning, obviously. And so in the upper right, we see the hospital basically moved outside. And after it moved outside, the lower left, they're trying to provide care, which is basically impossible. You don't see IVs, you don't see medical equipment, people are just lying in the streets. But that did not stop a further attack, which is the lower right. And that's what these multiple attacks do. In Kosovo, this goes back 10 years. The picture is of a clinic. A lot of the care in Kosovo was in local medical offices, just the way we have here. And there are over 100 facilities destroyed by Serb forces. 58 of them were taken for military purposes. There were 61 facilities where patients were actually expelled. And we know of at least 22 Kosovo Albanian doctors who were arrested and prosecuted for engaging in hostile acts against the state, which was allegedly treating members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. That is, complying with their ethical duty to provide care. And three of them, we think, were murdered, and 12 at least were tortured. Nepal was a different situation, where there was a Maoist insurgency for many years, and the insurgents used healthcare as a weapon. They destroyed hospitals, they attacked ambulances, but then they changed strategies. They were trying to win over the civilian population by providing health services. And the way they did it is basically by conscripting health workers to provide care. And so they were requiring health workers, sometimes by kidnapping them, to provide health care both to the civilian population and their own cadres. And they were also indoctrinated and forced to attend mass meetings. They were forced to speak about it, and they were punished by the government for doing that. So they're completely in a double bind, that they were forced by the rebels to provide care, and they were punished by the government. And in some cases, including the United States, because they had provided care to rebel forces, they were denied asylum when they after escaping, having been kidnapped, but they were denied asylum because they provided care to alleged terrorists. Bahrain is the most recent example where doctors and nurses were prosecuted, ambulance workers were attacked and killed, the doctors and nurses were prosecuted in a military court. It was international pressure which happily forced the government to overturn those convictions, but they may be retried in a civilian court. There's a date pending. Once again, they have been accused of acts contrary to the interests of the state. Some of the allegations that they were trying to overthrow the government, but other allegations were that they were supporting people who were engaged in demonstrations. APHA sent a letter, yes, to the State Department urging that the State Department vigorously demand that the government of Bahrain stop the prosecutions. They didn't stop the prosecutions, as they said, but they have since been overturned, but the story is not over. So those are just three recent examples. There are many, many more, and we can see patterns here. We see attacks on the sick and wounded, which has to do with denial of impartial care, assaults on patients within facilities. That happened in Syria just a few weeks ago. Security forces went into a hospital and tortured patients within a hospital. Sometimes it involves denial or obstruction of access to facilities. Lots of attacks on medical personnel, all kinds of ways, from physical violence against them to coming into offices, taking records, looting, going through computers, looking for information on patients, and of course, as I mentioned, arrest, detention, and prosecution. Shell assaults on medical facilities themselves, shelling, looting, deprivation of water and electricity, other forms of assaults, and of course, attacks on ambulances, where we've seen this most prominently in the West Bank, over hundreds and hundreds of examples of Israeli Defense Forces interference with ambulances. And actually some years ago I was actually in part of an investigation where the ICRC, the Red Cross, had established a procedure for inspecting ambulances for weapons. After they passed inspections, they were allowed passage, and in some cases Israeli Defense Forces attacked them anyway. Then the last is the military use of facilities or the misuse of the Red Cross or Red Crescent emblem, that is, using a hospital as a military installation. In Fallujah, for example, when the Marines went in the Second Battle of Fallujah, there was a hospital at a very key strategic point. So the Marines went in and took over the hospital because they wanted it for the purposes of gaining a tactical advantage. Well, why does this happen? We can say it happens because there are a lot of bad people out there, but I think we need to do another level of analysis. Sometimes there are generalized attacks on populations, part of ethnic cleansing, destabilization of government. Sometimes it's because medical workers are seen as elites. That happened in Kosovo. They were seen as civic leaders, and it was a way of controlling the leadership. But I think we also have to come to terms with the fact that this is often an intelligent effort to gain a military advantage. It may be wrong, but it's intelligent. The Fallujah example is a perfect example where there was a hospital strategic location. Other examples are preventing combatants from returning to battle. That is why doctors are prosecuted or detained or prevented from treating people on one side or the other of the conflict. Sometimes it's to force people to leave an area if they don't have access to health care. In Gaza and other places, when there are great disparities in the kind of military capability of one side or the other, attacks on health facilities can be used as to gain a military advantage. And sometimes it's used simply to intimidate the local population, which is maybe siding with a rebel group. Sometimes it's to carry out laws, which we find unusual. Why would gross violations of the Geneva Conventions be seen as a way of carrying out a law? Because there are laws on anti-terrorism, which I'll get to in a minute. Now, this is all unlawful under international law. Everything I've talked about is unlawful. That the Geneva Conventions are very, very strong, and those provisions have been incorporated in what we call customary international humanitarian law. We don't need to go into that. This is not a legal discussion, but we need to know how powerful the protections are. It protects all facilities for medical purposes, not just soldiers, civilians as well. There's a duty of impartial care. That is, you can't distinguish based on their political beliefs or affiliation. And even if a facility is misused, you must minimize the harm from your attack. And in fact, in the Fallujah example, the Marines, although they violated the law, they did seek to minimize the loss of life or injury and didn't kill any of the patients. Didn't justify what they did, but that requirement is there. There's also a very important requirement, and very unusual, that international law requires respect for medical and nursing ethics. Pretty unusual that it has the force of law. And what that means is you can't punish someone for acting consistently with medical ethics, for example, in providing impartial care, and you can't compel someone to act inconsistently with their ethics. Not only that, the acts I've described are considered war crimes. They're under the Geneva Conventions, they're categories of what's called a grave breach, and in the statute of the International Criminal Court, these kinds of activities I've described, intentionally directing attacks against medical units and transports and personnel, are war crimes. But there have never been any prosecutions since the Nuremberg trials of Nazi doctors in the 1940s. Not only that, Geneva Conventions about the law of war. We have civil conflicts, like in Bahrain and Syria. Those aren't wars. Those are internal conflicts. I have civil conflicts, not even characterized as internal wars. But under human rights law, there, even though the provisions aren't as specific, the recognition that human rights law basically provides the same kind of protections as humanitarian law, although that's not nearly as explicit. UN human rights mechanisms have recognized that human rights law covers these kinds of acts, and it's been reflected in reports from the High Commissioner for Human Rights. But here's the big but, and here's the message or the concern that leads me to be talking to you today. Unlike other areas of human rights law, of human rights generally, there is a complete absence of documentation, prevention, and accountability mechanisms in our international human rights and humanitarian law system. An absence, and that is a huge problem. And it's a special problem because there are political obstacles to adherence to the norms that I've described. First of all, groups don't have access, so they don't get information. As I just mentioned, there are no international mechanisms or systems for reporting and accountability. There's a lack of political will because there's no animated constituency. There's no one putting pressure on governments or human rights institutions to say you need to do more. That's changed a little bit in the last 6 months because of the Arab Spring conflicts, where the attacks on health in Libya and Syria and Bahrain have been so gross, I use the word gross in the kind of humanitarian law sense, a major violation, that it's gained international attention. But we don't see this in the Central African Republic or in Burma, where these attacks also take place, because they're not otherwise in the news. And we can contrast this with a lot of international attention to attacks on humanitarian aid workers. Well, that's completely justified to have that attention. There should be attention to attacks. But most health workers in the world are not international aid workers. They're indigenous health workers. So there's a big disparity between the attention to aid workers and indigenous workers. And all of this results in lack of diplomatic pressure. And this earlier, the last issue I want to mention is what I mentioned before, I alluded to before, is that criminal law in the United States and many other countries criminalizes material support to terrorists. In Serbia, the prosecutions that I mentioned of the 21 doctors were based on assistance to organizations that they had labeled terrorists, in that case, the Kosovo Liberation Army. And here we have similar laws that are interpreted to apply to medical services, even though the law itself makes no mention of medical services as encompassed within the law, and even though it lists many other things. So what do we need to do? There are opportunities to address this situation. We almost have a blank slate. There are three elements that are key. And this is true for all human rights, but it's certainly true here. We need to strengthen documentation so we know what's going on, because the whole human rights movement has grown up on the proposition, which I think has been amply proven, that information is power. Second, we have to strengthen formal accountability mechanisms and diplomatic initiatives. Finally, we have to strengthen prevention activities. Well, what's happening? There are things happening. And there's an opportunity as we sit here today to make a huge amount of progress. For the first time ever, the U.S. State Department Country Reports on Human Rights, which have become a major report, and respected, I have to say, report on human rights violations that comes out every year for 150 countries in 50 languages, they've agreed for the first time to have information specifically on this problem. And embassies around the world will be reporting on this back to Washington, and these reports will come out. I think that's a major advance because these reports have become very important. So I've been in countries by chance where the report comes out and it's the front page news. How did the country report on human rights treat us this year? And even though we may think of ourselves as cynical about whether these are biased reports, over the course of the 30 years these reports have come out, they become ever more impartial and insulated from political influence. But we need to develop uniform standards for reporting. We need to have an instrument that people can use that complies and follows the law. And we have to have some international agency, really, that will collect this information. And in my view, the World Health Organization is well situated to do this, based on its mission, based on the fact that it has country representatives all over the world. And we've had progress there, too. The Director General has spoken generally on a commitment to develop methods. And what we need is a resolution from the governing body of WHO, the World Health Assembly. And this may come up as early as next spring or the following spring. The second thing we need to do is strengthen accountability. We also had some progress there. In July, the UN Security Council passed a resolution that strengthened an existing mechanism for protection of children in armed conflict, which will now list persistent violators of attacks on hospitals, which is meant to include other health facilities and personnel, where children are affected. And there are very few institutions that provide health care that provide services to children that don't also provide services to adults. So it's very broad. But there has to be more political organizing to expand diplomatic protests and demands, and we can see the impact when there are such demands, as in the case of Bahrain I've spoken about. A third thing we need to do is we have to have prosecutions. Prosecutions have great symbolic value. I explained that these acts are war crimes, and we need to have either the International Criminal Court or some other international or domestic judicial proceedings to hold people, individuals, accountable. The last thing is to strengthen prevention. And here we also have an opportunity. Next month, the International Committee of the Red Cross is going to be holding a conference which is specifically focused on prevention. They launched a campaign in August called Healthcare in Danger, where they want to review military practice. They want to help engage non-state actors in gaining compliance. They want to have practices that people can, that military groups, everybody operating a checkpoint can do so more safely. And there's a kind of cynicism about non-state actors. I want to just tell you a story about the Taliban. We think of the Taliban as completely non-compliant with international norms on attacks, but they're very—they're much more sophisticated than you would think, and they too are trying to win over the population. And most of their attacks, not all, but most of their attacks are directed as what they consider military targets. We may not consider them military targets, but for example, when they attack civilians in government, we may not consider that a military target, but they do. But they certainly recognize an attack on a hospital is not a military target. And through the work of the Red Cross, they have the Taliban leadership a couple of months ago actually issued a statement condemning an attack on a hospital that killed about 20 people by one of its own splinter groups. So they are, through the work of the Red Cross, they are starting to recognize these norms, and much more has to happen. And finally, we have to sever medical care from anti-terrorism. That is absolutely essential, and it's one where our own country is a laggard. So there's a lot going on, and I'm just listing some organizations that have been involved in kind of an emerging coalition on trying to strengthen prevention, accountability, and documentation. This is a list of a handful of organizations, but you'll see at the bottom, APHA has been involved, which is very encouraging. And I put my email and my colleague's email on there if you'd like to be involved. There is a great opportunity in the next 2 years to make enormous headway to increase protection for health workers, patients, hospitals, and ambulances in war.